Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Today, we're going to take you back in time to the Bush era and talk with super lobbyist Jack Abramoff. He's out of prison, and he's published a book called Capital Punishment, capital with an O, subtitled The Hard Truth About Washington Corruption from America's Most Notorious Lobbyist. Jack Abramoff, we've been talking about you for years, and I'm delighted to be able to speak to you personally. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I want to start with the back of your book, because I'm fascinated by what you chose to do. Most authors get friends, usually famous writers, to pen little blurbs for them. This is the best book ever written. Oh, you'll never be able to put it down. And instead, you put up critical comments. Jack Abramoff, he's scum. Lower than pawn scum. He's a creep and we hate him. The most evil lobbyist ever to be operating in Washington. What was your thought there?
Well, those were the best comments I could get. publisher, like as you say, that you know they asked for positive comments about the book, but I hadn't shown my book to anyone, and I really wasn't in a position, frankly, to get people to make positive comments, considering how controversial I've been. And so I decided that readers might be more provoked by taking a look at some of the negative things that were said.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jack, I want to come clean. I've been talking about you for years, and you've probably not heard a word of it. I had a syndicated radio show from 2005 until 2009, and prior to that, I was on Sirius Satellite Radio. And once your story came public, and once we learned about Tom DeLay's K Street Project, you were one of our favorite pinatas. And I want you to hear the little ditty that we used to introduce you and some of your colleagues when we talked about these issues.
Here we go, starting another war. We got our heads up our asses. You know, we're really bored. Hey, hey, we're the Republicans. And people say we act like clowns. We love natural disasters. Did somebody really drown? We lie whenever we want to. Yeah, you know it's true. And if you don't believe us, turn on the nightly news. Hey, hey, we're the Republicans. And people say we act like clowns.
Now, Jack, I don't know if you were a Monkees fan, but that's where that tune was lifted from.
I was a big Monkees fan. I never heard that version, though.
Well, I'd be happy to email it to you if you'd like to add it to your collection.
That'd be great. Absolutely.
Now, a couple of pages in from the back of your book, you close with really a kind of confession and an acceptance of responsibility. And if I may, I'd like to read part of this and ask you to expand a little bit.
Sure.
You say, waiting to be discharged after serving 185 weeks in federal prison, I sat in the same holding cell I occupied on the day I was admitted to Cumberland. With my head bowed, I thought about my journey and the lessons I learned. I pondered how a person with every opportunity in life, unlike so many of my fellow inmates in the prison, could have veered off course so dramatically. Life is always complicated, and mine was probably more complex than most, but ultimately, I was the cause of my difficulties. regardless of my rationalizations, I was the one who didn't disclose to my clients that there was a conflict of interest in the arrangement I had with my partner to split the profits from the programs they funded. I was the one who lavished contributions, meals, event tickets, travel, golf, and jobs on innumerable federal public officials with the expectation or understanding that they would take official actions on my behalf or on behalf of my clients. I was the one who diverted income from those activities to nonprofits and other entities, thereby evading federal income taxes. These activities added to the corruption which engulfs our nation's capital, and I'm not proud of my part in it. Sure, I did a lot of good during my years as a lobbyist for my clients, my firms, and many needy people, but I also broke the law, for which my family and I paid a dear price. I continue to pay that price every day of my life. Now, that you make some important statements here. Tell me how this apologia has been received, particularly those by those who were hurt by the work that you did.
Well, a lot of the people who, you know, I've hurt, who were hurt by everything that took place, where I could, I tried to reach out previous to writing the book. I think that the apologies that I offer in the book and that I've since offered everywhere have been received for the most part pretty well. Obviously, there are people who are still hostile and always will be hostile toward me, and there's not much I can really do about it. All I can do is just try to do, at this point in my life, what's right. You know, even with that, there are people who are skeptical and don't want to hear any more from me, would prefer I go away. And frankly, I think I'd prefer I go away. It'd be easier, certainly, than what I've embarked to do now, and which is to reach out and to try to talk about the system that I was involved in. But for the most part, I've been very grateful that people have been very understanding and very willing to listen to my apologies.
Mm-hmm. And Chuck Colson spent some time in prison as a result of the Watergate episode. And it really changed his life, and he has worked for prison reform and worked on behalf of inmates and restorative justice since then. Did you have any kind of a catharsis that makes you want to try to help people who've been sent to prison?
Well, definitely. I mean, I don't think you can go to prison and not want to help people who are in similar straits. It's a little more difficult for me right now because I'm on probation, so I'm not permitted to have any contact with other felons and folks who are in the system. So those efforts to help people who are going through this are going to just have to wait till I'm allowed by the rules to do that. But again, there's no way you can go through this and not want to help those who are also going through it. It's the most horrific experience one can imagine. What I am trying to do in the interim is, and which I'm allowed to do, is to reach out and to try to help make some recompense in terms of the lobbying system and the political system that I was involved in. And certainly in the short term, I'm hopeful that that will be some bit of good that I can do.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jack, I've had contact with a lot of prisoners over the years. I like to tell it this way, that I've visited San Quentin over 100 times, but never been asked to spend the night. And I've worked on behalf of prisoners with a credible claim of innocence. And you might find it curious, but the organization I'm involved with is called the Freedom Foundation. And it was started here in California by a San Quentin inmate. And through it, I've learned a lot about people who go to prison, about how it changes them, some much worse, some for the better. And I'm just curious, internally, you made the comment that, you know, you'd like to get away from Jack Abramoff, at least the old version, sometimes yourself. Did the process really give you time for meditation and really help you see, you know, a new inside Jack Abramoff?
Well, I think the analysis that I did of who I am, who I was, and what I was doing and what I was involved in started taking place well before I went to prison. By the way, as it did with Chuck Colson, when he got to prison, I think he had already reformulated his approach, and I think the same is true with me. Prison doesn't really give you a lot of time to sit around thinking. Frankly, it doesn't give you a lot of quiet places to think. I did take advantage of the track outside where I guess is the quietest place you can walk around and not be bothered. But prison is not really about getting sort of free time to sit around a lounge. It's very noisy. It's very you have no privacy. We lived 106 men to 150 square feet, so you can imagine there's just no real moment that you have to yourself.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel you deserved it?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say that because obviously, on the one hand, I was suffering through it, so it's hard to, and again, I'm just trying to be honest. It'd be easy for me to say, yeah, I deserved it, and I knew I deserved it. But while I was going through it, I hated every minute of it. I clearly felt I did things that were wrong. I got to tell you, I think that the penal system in America is dysfunctional. And I don't know that it's set up in a most efficient way. For example, I volunteered and said, look, instead of me just sitting around all day, why don't you put me to work teaching in the inner city schools? Why don't you put me to work sweeping reservations, cleaning? What is the point of the taxpayer paying for me to just sit in here and do nothing all day? So in that respect, it was, one looks at prison and wonders what's going on with it. But at the end of the day, my family suffered tremendously. I suffered tremendously. Whether it was the right amount of suffering or the wrong amount of suffering, clearly I had done wrong. I was punished from the minute that my life fell apart. People underestimate the effect of international disgrace has on a person. It's devastating. And in some ways, it's worse than going to prison. So the entire system of justice in America, I would say, needs a real hard look at what's an effective and efficient and way to punish people. I'm not certain we're there yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm with you on that. The International Freedom Foundation, you were involved with that in the late 80s, early 90s. And in the book, you give us a lot of early history of Jack Abramoff, the Young Republicans, your connection to Karl Rove, Grover Norquist, your meetings with Ronald Reagan. You talk about producing the film Red Scorpion, but you don't mention anything about the International Freedom Foundation. Was it left out for space reasons, or did you think it wasn't relevant?
No, my first draft, I wrote about it, but what happened was the publisher and the editors felt that I had far too much material before I became a lobbyist. And it frankly wasn't an important part of my life. I was asked to become head of the IFF by a friend who was running it, Russell Crystal, and I wasn't really actively involved in the thing. I made one trip to meet some of their donors, but it was pretty much it. So it wasn't a real, vital part of my life, and I think they felt that, they cut back on a lot of my stories. I had a ton more, and mm-hmm. I probably had almost 100 more pages in there, frankly, in the draft, and mm-hmm. A lot of it got cut. They wanted to sort of cut to the chase of when I was a lobbyist. They felt that was probably what was more interesting to most people.
Mm-hmm. And you're aware that the IFF, when the South African Truth Commission held its hearings, was described as a part of the apartheid regime's propaganda operations, and that they sent their fee payments directly to the IFF, the Washington office, from the intelligence agency in South Africa?
Well, I don't think the last part, as I remember it, I don't think the last part's accurate. My understanding was they sent it, and it was unbeknownst totally to us that they were involved at all, that they sent the money to the folks in South Africa. When I met them, they basically said that, again, they wanted to set up a foundation to fight apartheid, to fight the Soviets, to be a consistent freedom foundation, and I was very supportive of that. When I was involved in it, I was introduced to what I was told were the donors, which were liberal corporate folks in South Africa, many of whom were involved in the anti-apartheid movement. And later it came out that they had financial dealings with the government, but I was well gone from the organization, and I'd never heard of anything like that, as I said at the time. So it wasn't really, again, my activities with them were so minimal to begin with, and second of all, we came out and we supported the release of Nelson Mandela from prison at a time, by the way, when other conservative groups were definitely not in favor of that. I actually took it on the chin with that and politically in D.C., and I wasn't unhappy to do it, but what can one do? I mean, ultimately, you find out sometimes some surprising things. But again, I was so far gone from the organization, there was not anything I could have done about it at that point.
Jack, the information I have about the payments being sent to the IFF Washington office is testimony from a police official named Vic McPherson.
Mm-hmm.
and he ran the security branch operations for the apartheid government there.
Right. It may be, by the way, that after I left they did that, but I can tell you when I was there, you know, the payments that we got were only from the IFF in South Africa, in the Johannesburg branch. Mm-hmm. Where they got their money, I don't know. But, you know, what can I tell you? I wouldn't have accepted, by the way, money from any government. I was an anti-governmental program guy. And even if it was the U.S. government, I wouldn't have accepted it. So, you know, as I said at the time, this was all sort of old stuff from, you know, years ago. But, you know, just to review it, it's not something I would have abided by if I knew mm-hmm. about it.
And what about your work on behalf of Mobutu Sese Seko, the dictator of Zaire?
Well, I never worked for Mobutu Sese Seko. That was incorrect.
Oh.
What I did was I lobbied on behalf of André Soussan, who was the editor of Politique Internationale, for an effort to get Mobutu to step down from power, which involved Mobutu coming to the United States to announce what he put in writing, which was that he would hand over power to Tshisekedi, Etienne Tshisekedi, who was a leading democratic official there at the time. It was misreported as my lobbying for Mobutu. I never had any relationship with Mobutu, and frankly, our efforts were condemning of Mobutu.
All right, let me move on to some of the questions that I believe Leslie Stahl should have asked you on 60 Minutes, and I was there yelling back at my TV set as I watched the interview. And I feel that in the book and in that interview, you seriously downplayed Tom DeLay's connection to your lobbying efforts, Tom DeLay's setup of the so-called K Street Project, where you and other well-connected Republican lobbyists were invited to actually write legislation and submit it, and the combination of legislative access and huge campaign contributions that were flowing either through you or at your direction during that time made you, I think, much more significant to the speaker's efforts than you acknowledge in the book and, as I said, on the 60 Minutes interview.
Well, let me first tell you, Tom DeLay was never speaker. He was a majority leader.
Oh, pardon me, yes, you're right.
But in terms of the K Street effort, obviously I was aware of it. I was not, but the K Street effort was, just so you understand, was an effort to get more Republicans and conservatives hired on K Street. And it was something that Tom was obviously very active in. He was very open about it. He made it very clear that he was sick of being lobbied by liberals who had come in to lobby him and made money off of it. And he felt that these lobbying firms and these companies should have hired conservatives. Now, I was already there already. I was already a hired conservative on the street. I hired liberals and conservatives. My firm was a bipartisan firm. And I had, at that point, Republicans controlled the Congress. About a third of our folks were liberals, Democrats and liberals, I guess. And about two-thirds were Republicans, as the Congress is the main focus of our lobbying efforts. So I wasn't necessarily involved as, you know, if you think it through, I wasn't really involved in terms of getting other firms to hire Republicans. If anything, I would have not, frankly, been happy with it because it would have been competition to me. In terms of money that we raised, you know, I think I was pretty open in the book that I raised as much money as I could.
For me, the issue is the linkage of the contributions and the access that led to specific legislation benefiting clients of you and other lobbyists.
Oh, I thought I was very open about that. And if not, let me make it clear. As with me, by the way, and it wasn't just me and the Republican lobbyists. This happens all day on K Street, that money is the reason that lobbyists had their access. It wasn't something I invented. It was something I worked pretty hard to exploit, unfortunately, in those days. But money is the problem in the system. And it's not Republican only, by the way. It's very much Democrat as well. And DeLay was not the only member of Congress or the only leader in Congress to be pressing that advantage. They all do. And that's one of the reasons why I come out in the book and speak very strongly that we've got to remove money from the system in terms of in the hands of the lobbyists and their clients.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk a little bit about how you helped Tom DeLay appreciate the value of Native American tribes to his political operation. And in particular, the work that you did on behalf of the Choctaw tribe that earned you a couple of $1 million and led to an unprecedented piece of legislation that makes the Choctaw the only tribe that is allowed to regulate its own gambling operations?
Well, what happened was, I'm glad you asked it. To say you're actually the first person who's interviewed me has asked about that, because I think it's an example of kind of how egregious things get in Washington. The Native American tribes who set up their gambling operations, a number of them spent millions of dollars in hiring outside folks, setting up separate legitimate gaming commissions. In terms of hiring folks who weren't beholden to the tribe and were not directly compensated by the tribe, et cetera, to oversee their gaming operations. And they need to do this, by the way, as do all casinos, in order to convince customers that they're going to be playing legitimate games, by the way, that they're not going to be coming in and getting ripped off, among other things. Now, what happened was a bureaucratic organization called the National Indian Gaming Commission was set up and operated sort of on the margins, helped certain tribes to achieve certain things. That didn't have the kind of self-sufficiency that the Choctaws and other tribes did. And over time, a certain individual who was chief of staff for a member of Congress by the name of Kildee got into the role of executive director there, and he wanted to start increasing the budget, as is the want sometimes of folks in the bureaucracy, wanted to increase the budget exponentially of this group and to expand its power. Now, the tribes rankled and didn't want this to happen. As a consequence, they put forward a fee that each of the tribes would have to pay, even those tribes who are already paying this fee. The fee was ostensibly so that they would be able to set up a gaming commission. Well, the Choctaws and many other tribes are already spending millions of dollars to do it. And there was never a complaint, by the way, from any party that their gaming commissions were anything but fair and legitimate with outside directors, et cetera. Well, the Choctaws came to me and said, listen, this isn't fair. We already have a gaming commission. We don't, you know, they, Choctaws, you should note, at least in those days, spent all their money on their reservation. They didn't give, they hardly gave anything away in terms of these payments that you hear about sometimes with tribes, you know, paying $1 million to members and things like that. Under Chief Martin, they didn't do that. They spent all their money on health care and welfare and education and senior care and all the rest on their reservation. So they said that the money that's going to come out, several million a year, is going to wind up first of all, it's duplicative. It replicates what we're already doing, and it's not really a useful expenditure. So we went to work to see what was what, and we got involved in the thing. And we were able to get, by the way, it came out of the Senate, not the House, Senator Cochran, who was the senator who cared about this tribe because they were in his state, to move forward and to put language in, so that the fee that was due to the NIGC was due only from tribes who weren't already self-regulating. And that language went in and was approved. And to be sure that the Choctaws would be okay, Senator Cochran put forward, and we protected this in the House in the sense that we lobbied for it in the House, Senator Cochran put forward legislation that said self-regulating tribes such as the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. Because, as you may be well aware, sometimes folks in the bureaucracy play little games where they won't recognize congressional language, and we see it on every issue. So that language went through, and that was the law. Well, one day, we were busy fighting, I think, on the Indian Child Welfare Act. We were trying to preserve the ICWA, and all of a sudden, Congressman Kildee goes to the well of the floor during the middle of the fight and says he's got a technical amendment, a non-controversial technical amendment, and he puts it through on voice vote. It turns out his amendment was to strip the words self-regulating tribes such as, and he left in only Choctaw. Now, we weren't happy about that because, number one, we had other tribes that we were close to, as in the Choctaws were close to, and number two, no tribe or no entity wants to be left out there alone, you know, standing out there alone on a legislative thing. So we fought to try to get that turned around, and Senator Cochran was again in the lead to try to help us, and I write about this in the book in detail, but unfortunately, the other tribes that we went to, either because they had some lobbyists who didn't want to necessarily go along and take away what they thought would be a good opportunity for themselves, or because they couldn't get the senator in their state, we couldn't get anybody to join in, and we wound up having to leave that language. Mm-hmm. We weren't happy about it, but you know, we only represented Choctaw. But that's how that happened.
Now, I want to turn to the events in Alabama, because I have followed the saga of former Governor Don Siegelman in great detail. And you do touch on the Alabama issues in the book a little bit, but I'd like you to amplify a little bit more. Because after all, Siegelman is still potentially facing another stretch in federal prison. He was already in, I think, for about 18 months. And I believe that he was really framed and railroaded here. Do you have any remorse for the operation that you put in motion that has left Don Siegelman with millions of dollars in legal bills and an uncertain future?
Well, the only operation that I know we put in motion was an operation to beat him in the election. I don't know, frankly, I'm not as familiar as you probably are with this case, and I certainly wouldn't want to see him go to prison. Having been in prison, I don't want anybody to go to prison, but I'm not certain what, I mean, am I remorseful that we went after him politically in terms of beating him? Well, I mean, he was on the other side from what our clients wanted. Our clients didn't want to have gambling in Alabama because of their...
This was a state lottery for education.
Yes,
Siegelman was promoting.
Right.
And he was prosecuted by Carl Rove's former business partner's wife. Bill Canary's wife, Laura, was the U.S. attorney. She brought charges against him once and failed to convict, and then she allegedly recused herself, and a replacement brought a second round of charges that did result in convictions of Governor Siegelman. And while Laura Canary said she recused, she didn't.
I don't want to see anybody go to prison. I don't know really a lot about any of that. But in terms of the lottery, please understand that the efforts that we were engaged in Alabama were to stop any gambling from taking place, because the way the rules are written, the minute that any gambling is legalized in the state, the local tribe there, which is called the Porch Creek Indians, could have opened up a casino, which would have hurt the market of our client. That was the mission we were given by our client, and that's the one we proceeded to do. So we fought against the lottery. We fought against the opening of slots on the dog tracks. We fought against the opening of a casino by the tribe. We fought against basically everything, and we fought against Governor Siegelman's reelection because we felt that he was promoting these efforts. So that's what was behind it. I mean, I'm unaware of any illegal or improper activities on the part of any of the people I was involved with. I can't speak to Carl Rove and his friends and what they did to him. To Siegelman, I feel terrible for former Governor Siegelman. I don't know him, but again, I don't want to see anybody suffer through what I went through in prison.
So can you tell me point blank that you never enlisted your former assistant, Susan Ralston, who was Karl Rove's assistant in the White House, to run interference or communicate messages that led to the long-term prosecution of Governor Siegelman?
Absolutely. I tell you that point blank for sure.
Uh-huh. Okay. And the $20 million that your client spent in Alabama to defeat the lottery for education, Ralph
Reed... Well, not just the lottery for education. I mean, it's important to be accurate.
Okay.
We spent $20 million as for the things that I delineated, which were the lottery, which were the dog tracks, which were the Indian tribal casino, and which were the governor's reelection race.
So what role then did you play in helping Bob Riley win election in 2002? And you may recall that Siegelman was declared the winner on election night, and the next morning, you know, kind of like some other elections we've seen, they found 5,000 votes that flipped the result.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I wasn't involved at that level. All I did was direct our people to, you know, activate the coalition that we had built to beat gambling.
Mm-hmm.
To do what they could do. I wish I had some interesting information. I certainly would have put it in the book.
Did your colleague Michael Scanlon, who used to work for Riley, was he involved in that election in 2002?
Very much so.
And did he participate in any of the efforts to prosecute Don Siegelman?
I doubt it. I've never heard of anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you have any ties to Paragon Gaming? They were active.
I don't even know who they are.
Okay, they were active in Alabama, and they have ties to the Riley family.
Don't know them.
Okay. Briefly on the Sun Cruise investment that you made, Did you know that Adam Kadan had the kind of background he did? His mother was murdered by a Bonanno crime family assassin, and he had a number of misadventures before he reconnected with you. What was he, an old classmate or something?
No, he used to work for me as a young man. He went away and had apparently a very stormy career.
Uh-huh.
When he returned to me, he didn't reveal any of that. I only found out in the aftermath of his, frankly, stealing money from me and others that he was involved in that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Had I known that, I would have fled to the hills. Unfortunately, by the time I found it out, it was too late.
And you bought this shipping line from Gus Boulos, who was then murdered. Do you have any theories on who killed Gus Boulos? And I believe it's still unresolved as of now, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't really. I mean, I only met Gus once. You know, I haven't been involved at all in that case. I don't think anyone down there feels that I have anything to add.
Mm-hmm.
You know, apparently there was some mafia involvement, and they've arrested somebody. But other than what I read in the papers, I don't really know anything more than that.
All right. Jack Abramoff with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And, Jack, I've invited Tom Rogers to talk with us for a couple of minutes. He is a Blackfeet tribal member from Montana, and he was centrally involved in the efforts to expose your double dealing with Indian tribes. Tom, welcome to the program today.
Good afternoon, Peter.
And what would you like to say or ask Jack Abramoff, Tom?
Well, I think a couple of things I would like to ask Jack. I think one thing, and I think Jack was interviewed the other night on the Colbert Report, and he was asked what was his most disappointing, disgusting, or despicable act that he had engaged in, and I think I'm stating this correctly, that Jack said in trying to insert the language of opening up a casino in Texas in an election reform bill. But I think I would point to another one that was even more heartrending and dark, is that was referenced in a Lawrence O'Donnell interview, which was the fact that, as you know, in our community, in the tribal community, our elders are held in incredible regard. They're not like, you know, corporate executive officers or even how we would treat some of our own elders in white society.
Tom,
if you'd like to make a call,
yes.
Tom?
Hang up and try again.
Yes.
Jack Abramoff hung up on us.
Hang up and then dial your operator.
That's the sound you're hearing. And at first I thought it was just a noise on the line. I did hear the click.
Jack hung up?
Yes, he did.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again.
Wow.
So, I guess what we're learning here, Tom, is that there are limits to his ability to forgive and limits to his ability to confront his own wrongdoing, because you were very polite in the way you were addressing him. I didn't find you to be rude or difficult in any way, and he seemed to be willing to talk to me about many issues, but I guess talking with you ear to ear was just too much for him.
Well, I was going to ask him, Peter, that him and Michael, they said it, you know, that they did not really care about the Tiguas towards a certain point of their representation. But what they did was they went to the tribal council and they asked the council if they could take out life insurance policies on their elders so that they could offset their invoices, which the Tiguas could no longer pay, which were in excess of $5 million. The Tiguas could no longer pay them, so they said, well, I'll take an insurance policy out on your parents and your grandparents, and I'll apply those death benefit proceeds to my invoice.
That shows a lot of respect.
And I think that would be the most thing. And I've also heard that Jack, another thing that I would ask Jack if he was on the line or if he's listening now, is Jack emphasized that he had purchased some services from a couple of reporters, allegedly for Business Week, who he was buying favorable stories or favorable placement, but that was not divulged in any transparent way. I would have asked him if that was the same with Mr. Scanlon. Was Mr. Scanlon or was Jack aware of any other reporters that stories were actually paid for and never revealed, and so we were getting a much less open, a much less transparent, and Jack's buying of people's souls extended not only to politicians and staff, but it also extended to the media. And for a, you know, the fact checkers of the world, which is the media, and the check on power that they provide, that is one of the most even more revealing with regard to not only the political process, but the fact that even the own people who are supposed to be the ultimate check on power, which is the media, they were also bought. And whether that, we've just touched upon that in a very limited way, and whether that needs more examination.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Tom, I'm frustrated right now because I thought there was an opportunity here for Jack Abramoff to really come clean about the way he manipulated one tribe against the other in these efforts to super serve his high-paying clients. And, you know, for example, I take at face value that he doesn't know much about the Siegelman case. Either that or it's a well-rehearsed denial. Still, these issues related to Native Americans are really at the center of the misdeeds that he partially admits to and partially accepts responsibility for in his book and in this kind of rehabilitation media tour that he's on right now.
Well, and you even heard the reference to Senator Cochran's efforts. What was not referenced in that discussion today was that Ann Copeland, the chief of staff to Senator Cochran, was ensnared in this. So how he secured that NIGC amendment, I mean, Chief Martin had a wonderful relationship with Senator Cochran directly. He didn't need a lobbyist for that. That is representing your own constituent and a major constituent in your state. But we found out that even Ann Copeland, who is chief of staff to Senator Thad Cochran, got ensnared and sold legislative favors for basketball tickets.
That's one of the things I didn't touch on. Just for our listeners' benefit, there was a delay in the start of this interview, and Abramoff told us before I started recording that he could only go for about 40 minutes. So I had to limit. I didn't talk about the Marianas Islands, Saipan, which was the scene where Abramoff and the elected officials on his payroll went and ignored sweatshop conditions, human rights violations, and the exploitation of workers who were shipped to Saipan from China and other countries, and who often were wage slaves because of the manner in which they had been brought to these factories. And women were particularly exploited, and there were reports of prostitution and forced abortions of women who became pregnant, all of which, of course, fly in the face of the values that Jack Abramoff and his political cronies claim adherence to. So I didn't get to talk to that point. But, Tom, you got to hear the entire interview, and I'm curious because you've been watching Abramoff very closely since back in 2003 when, and let's let our listeners in on this, you and other Native Americans adopted a strategy of exposing Abramoff's misdeeds in very local newspapers in Mount Pleasant, Michigan, in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And a year later, those stories actually surfaced in the Washington Post, which really led to the Abramoff scandals. But tell me your thoughts as you heard him spin his way through, because even in his apology mode, he spun every issue I talked about. South Africa's apartheid regime. Oh, he helped release Nelson Mandela. And you know, when I talk about the Choctaws, oh, he was just a victim of Senator Cochran and his staff. And right. And so I find it very interesting how he continues to spin and think like the lawyer lobbyist he was before he went to prison.
I think it's very telling that if you look at the whole pattern of interviews, and what is said in those interviews, there's an enormous amount of deflection. There is a very limited acceptance of any personal responsibility. There is even the classic political strategy of, oh, I sent out hundreds and hundreds and thousands of emails, thousands, 850,000 emails, and only a percentage, because, you know, of course, it's not the intensity of those emails but it's only a small, small percentage. So I'm just a small sinner of what was said. And that, you know, that we were referenced as troglodytes, morons, retards, subhuman, monkeys. But that also, he was such in a comedic mode at that time that he extended that language to even his co-workers, perhaps, even his own children, he said. That, you know, he just had that habit. Well, I don't know about you, Peter, but I do know about myself. And I would like to think that I don't associate or I don't know people who refer to either their clients, their co-workers, or God forbid, their even their own children in that capacity, especially when he is taking our million-dollar checks as Native Americans that we could have used for prenatal care, health care, educational scholarships, and then dehumanizing us, because that's the way he could compartmentalize it, dehumanizing us as subhuman, so he could make that align in his own mind. And it's a classic. When Jack was talking about today, he didn't have a lot of time to think. I'm not quite sure of that, because from day one, from the day he entered that cell up there in Maryland, the day he left, it was all about a campaign, just like when he was a lobbyist, a campaign to rehabilitate Jack Abramoff.
Yeah.
That's what occupied his mind, not sincerity, not moral repair, but a campaign to rehabilitate how people perceive him and his own bank account.
And Tom Rogers, when we look at Jack Abramoff and the cynical way that he manipulated one tribal group against the other, and then enlisted Ralph Reed, the alleged guardian of Americans' morality, and Reed was passing out money, funneling money to tribes who would join in opposing, for example, in Alabama, the state level gambling of the lottery. And he's correct in pointing out dog tracks and other systems were proposed. But the bottom line is that he really shows himself to be unethical to the core, and that whatever, you know, like a warlord in Afghanistan, whoever paid me most recently the most amount of money is who I am going to fight brutally for, and everybody else just has to get out of the way, and we will find any way we can to maneuver or manipulate those people to achieve the result that we're getting paid for.
And Peter, this town is, there's no doubt about it, is this town can corrupt a person. It is a corruptible city and a corruptible process. The question is, in that human condition, in that human element, are you going to be, and like I said, a person reveals his character when he, by his conduct, when he thinks no one is watching. Well, when no one was watching, Abramoff emailed to Michael Scanlon after he found out that the Tiguas were having to close their Speaking Rock Casino, and a 60-year-old elderly woman was quoted as saying, "I'm an old lady. It's going to be difficult for me to find another job." And Jack's response, as he emailed Mike Scanlon, "Fire up the jet, baby. We're going to El Paso." And Mike responded, "I want all of their money." And Abramoff's response, "Yowza." So when they thought no one was looking, not like today, when he knows people are watching him, what did they do? They took people at their weakest point in their lives, out of money, out of health care, out of jobs, and manipulated that all for money, and then called them subhuman names while they were taking their money. And if that wasn't enough, then they sought to pay their own bills with the death of the Tigua tribal elders.
Tom, a couple of weeks back when we set up this interview and it got moved a couple of times, and thank you for your patience in working with us on the schedule changes. But when I first invited you to be a surprise guest for Jack Abramoff, your line to me was a classic. You said, "Well, it's about time an Indian gets to ambush a white guy." And I want to turn that around into a very serious comment, because the Native Americans have never really been free from ambushes of white men. And while they don't use guns anymore, alcohol is a major source of destruction in the Native American communities. And, of course, we know that the federal government has never honestly accounted for or paid Indian tribes the monies owed dating back, at least 100 years, for the property that we stole from tribal groups. And in many cases, we stole resource-rich property that was exploited, and none of that money, or very little of it, was properly paid to the tribes who had a clear claim originally to these lands. So I'd like to hear your thoughts about the continuing ambush of Native Americans, because Jack Abramoff is really just one prick. I was going to say prick point, but I'll just leave it as prick.
Well, there was over 100 and some 50 years ago, at the height, towards the end of the Civil War, the largest mass execution that ever took place on our native soil occurred in Mankato, Minnesota, where over 30-some Native American men were simultaneously hung by this country for an alleged massacre in Minnesota. At one point, over 300 were scheduled to be executed. And so how many people on your phone realize that the largest mass execution held on our soil was when over 30 Native American men were hung at the same time? And they stemmed out the fact that they were starving to death in Minnesota. And so they went out because the DI agent who was allegedly supposed to be taking care of them, was taking their rations, their money, and diverting it to his own needs. And so they hunted him down, the Sioux did, and they killed him, and they stuffed him in grass in his mouth. And as a takeoff of almost a modern day, which is attributed to Marie Antoinette, which is sometimes in doubt, because that DI agent told them, if those Indians are starving, let them eat grass. And so when I read Jack's emails, I'm taken back to that horrible treatment. And you shouldn't use history to imprison you, but you should use it to inform you. And Jack and Michael and Kevin and Tony Rudy and Steve Griles and Bob May.
And pause just a second. Let's go through the list again. Michael Scanlon, who was a key lobbying partner of Jack Abramoff. Right. You mentioned Bob Ney, a member of Congress, Republican from Ohio, who did go to prison for his involvement with Abramoff. And who else did you mention there?
Tony Rudy, Deputy Chief of Staff to Tom DeLay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Steve Griles, who was the number two. The number two at Interior. This corruption extended all the way to the number two individual at the Department of Interior, who has the trustee relationship to take care of tribes. He also got involved in this with Jack. You had also Ann Copeland, Chief of Staff to Senator Thad Cochran. You had Susan Ralston,
right,
an assistant to the president. Susan Ralston, who used to work for Jack,
mm-hmm,
who ended up working with Karl Rove.
And isn't it amazing that he can't remember any time that Susan Ralston, you know, helped him communicate with Karl Rove about nailing Don Siegelman? I can't believe that.
Well, especially given the fact that Karl Rove, when it comes to political actions in this country, is, especially during the Bush administration, I think that was in his portfolio. I might be wrong, but I think political strategy was one of the skill sets that Karl Rove allegedly brought to the White House.
And to imagine, given their histories back to the young Republicans in the late 70s, early 80s, the idea that Abramoff didn't engage Rove in his efforts to cage Don Siegelman in Alabama, I mean, that doesn't pass a fundamental smell test. And the only strong circumstantial evidence I can summon here is the way Karl Rove's emails conveniently disappeared for almost 3 years,
mm-hmm,
during the critical time when Siegelman was pressing his case and the allegations of White House-level interference with U.S. attorneys were not confined to Alabama. And Karl Rove was at the center of that. And to imagine that, here we have Abramoff acknowledging he spent $20 million in total to mess up Don Siegelman and the state of Alabama and its interest in developing state revenues from gambling of different sorts. It's just really hard to believe, because he discloses in the book in detailed ways the manners that he used to get juice legislation passed and to achieve nefarious goals that his clients advocated for. And so to imagine that, he just doesn't know nothing about nothing, well, I don't believe it, frankly.
No, you are right. I mean, there is, you cannot argue ignorance or incompetence or lack of knowledge for an individual and a group of Team Abramoff who prided themselves of knowing everything and accomplishing everything. Well, they accomplished things. They accomplished what they bought. There wasn't too many great and grand strategy, and all of this grassroots, hiring the best grassroots vendors, that was all a charade and a fog. What they got is what they bought, whether it was certain Texas pastors in Texas, whether it was other staffers. They got only what they bought. It wasn't the power of their argument. It was the power of their purse.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you for what you and other Native Americans started in 2003 to expose this man. And he has in turn brought light to the system that he was running and maneuvering through. And yet we haven't seen any changes. President Obama campaigned saying that he was going to, stop the revolving door, and that's not really happened. And the influence of lobbyists has only increased since the Democrats returned to Washington in 2008. So as you look at this, is there any hope, or do you think the Occupy people have the right general notion that this system is so deeply broken that it really, can't be fixed by a little correction here, a little tweaking there?
I think that, we're harvesting what has occurred over the past 20, 30 years now, whereas there's this blinded worshiping of the almighty dollar, and that has corrupted our souls. It's corrupted how we view government. It's corrupted how we view business. Not to say that capitalism isn't the best method of economic enable this country or this world has been able to reach out and accomplish to date, but when you take it to the extreme, when like any ideology of any sort, taken to its extreme with mindless and reckless greed and avarice and hubris. And that's what's occurred now. Now we can, if man were an angel, we wouldn't need laws or regulations, but he is not an angel. He's completely fallible. And therefore we need processes in place like laws, regulations, complete transparency, so people will have faith, so they don't feel like they're being lied to. They'll believe in our institutions and in our leaders again, because all they feel like they're being lied to constantly, constantly, every day, and that there's an inside job going on that doesn't benefit them, it only benefits a few. And then you start to think of yourself as a victim, and then you give up hope, and then you become apathetic, and then you become cynical. And that's where we're at. And until we, at a more value-laden term, not yes, sunlight helps, transparency helps, but until we do a corrective action that the almighty, you don't measure a man's worth by the size of his wallet, and you look at his soul and what he truly values, that is when we'll have a corrective to this incredible avarice and economic Darwinism that we've got going on in this country anymore, and which has corrupted our politics, and corrupted our business, and corrupted our personal lives.
Tom Rogers from the Blackfoot Nation, it's a real pleasure to know you, and I'm sorry you didn't get even an acknowledgement from Jack Abramoff today.
Well, thank you, Peter, for the time, and I know at some point Jack and I will meet, and we will have this discussion, and only when we do have this discussion, and there is an acknowledgement on his part, because the fact that he could not participate in this dialogue itself means that any apology still rings hollow until he can visibly own, stand in front of his accusers, and visibly own what he did.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Peter.
And thank you for listening. Share this podcast far and wide, and then send me a note, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails to you.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.